Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studio. Do you want to know more about workforce and school inclusivity when it comes to autism and disabled students? Do you have a child who's disabled and you want to know at what age you should get an IEP? Well, my next guest, Karen Gilmore, and I talk all about that and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today I'm joined with autism advocate Karen Gilmore. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you so much.
So why don't you start off by telling me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am an autistic advocate. I'm an autistic educator, which is I work in special education, and I work with I'm starting my work with DVU, which is Disability Voices United, as a project manager for them. And then I also work with the NeuroDrive team, which is a subdivision of Mind Your Autistic Brain.
All right. So you are autistic, as you just said. When were you diagnosed?
I was young. I got the, we think you're autistic at 18 months, and then the official diagnosis at 3.
So you were diagnosed pretty young.
I'm the golden standard, actually, for diagnosis of autism specifically.
So as you got older and your parents told you you were autistic, what was your view on that?
Well, for me, honestly, it was both like a, okay, that makes sense. And why did you hide it from me? And so it was like kind of a journey for what autism meant to me and how open I am about it now. I used to be very closed about it and kind of try to hide it. Now I'm very open and, you know, obviously I advocate. So it was a process, I would say, you know, like I was 12 when they told me. So I was,
wow,
you know, yeah.
So they waited till you were 12 years old till they told you.
Yeah.
Did you have any special interests growing up? I mean, things that became like your hyper focus?
Yeah. Barbies was a big one. Princesses, Beauty and the Beast, particularly. I was very, my mom said, like, I was really lucky. We got me into services, when I was young. So I was kind of like a sponge and took it all in. And I would say that really kind of helped me out. And that's why I always push for people, like the younger you can get it, the better, because then you can get more resources, particularly, sorry, when it comes to like around the world, there are more resources for kids. Mm-hmm. And I think that's played a big role in my life and where I stand today.
When did you decide to become an advocate?
College, actually.
Wow, so late.
I was, yeah, oh yeah, no, I tried to hide my disability, hide my autism all throughout high school. Once I knew, I was like, oh no. And then I, when I was in college, I met this amazing professor. Her name is Dr. Christina Rusk. And she was like, you need to share your story. Like, you know, she was the one who taught me so much about disabilities and everything. It was incredible. And I'll never forget it because I was like, when she said in the class, tell these teachers, you know, special educators, our goal is to diagnose kids at 18 months. That's like the best time to get it in there. And I was like, that's when I was diagnosed. You know, and so you just, I began guest lecturing in her course, helped them, you know, out with their autism course and everything. And I just kind of began speaking more about it. And then I was brought into IEPs by my teacher friends and colleagues at college for parents who were really struggling with IEPs, that they didn't want their kid to be autistic. They didn't want that stigma, you know? And so it was, that's really how I began my advocacy, was wanting to help others.
Yeah, I've come across a lot of that. Since I started advocating for myself, a lot of parents don't want to give their child their stigma. How do you deal with that when you have a client come in and say, my folks don't want to accept my diagnosis?
Well, as a educator, I dealt with that a lot. and so I found, it's going to sound really funny, the best way was telling parents I'm disabled, because they're like, you don't look autistic. You don't feel autistic. You're not the like person I normally see. I'm considered, I hate the terminology and I apologize, but high functioning. And so they're like, wait, my kid can function. Like, I don't have to, like, you know, I'm like, yeah, like we can live lives. So just having a really candid conversation with parents about my journey as an autistic woman has been something really powerful. And just talking it out with parents, particularly being like, you know, I understand also, right? Because like when I was younger, I didn't want that stigma of being autistic and the disabled person either. So coming at it with the empathy and just a conversation, and it's not easy, you know, it's a process. So I think allowing people to have that process helps. But yeah, it's how I began my journey, was helping out those parents. So everyone else is, you know, I'm like, I could do this.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had that feeling too originally of, oh, I don't want to be labeled disabled, because my mom is like, you need to get on Social Security. And I'm like, no, I don't want to be labeled that way. And then eventually it just came around to, you know, it's the only way I'm going to get help.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to tell people as well. You may not like the word disabled, but it's the only way you're going to get help in school and out of school.
And it's not a bad word. Like, it really isn't. It's just something that we are labeled as to help us. And I know I have an English degree. It's my bachelor's. You know, that term, you know, the prefix dis is the inability to. Mm-hmm. But yet we have the ability to do so much more. And we just need supports. So that's what I tell people. Like, think about it as a support system. Everyone needs it. Ours is just a little more specialized. And we have laws to back us up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we do have laws that back us up. I mean, companies can't discriminate against us if we tell them we're disabled, and schools need to work with us because it's just how it goes.
Yeah.
And that brings me to another question is, how soon should a parent, once they find out their child is disabled, get an IEP?
Well, this is a hard one. I actually have a whole course on this. So if you're interested, at Mind Your Autistic Brain Subdivision NeuroDrive, you can see courses on IEPs. An initial IEP is what you're talking about. So highly recommend, if you're a parent, go for that course. Because long story short, it's very individualized. And the process of getting an IEP is a very long one. It can take months to years. And there's, like I said, I made a whole course on it because it is so complex. Just remember that just because your child has a diagnosis does not guarantee them an IEP.
Mm. That's something I did not know.
A lot of people don't. And that's why I was, that's why I made a whole course on this, because it's the teacher jargon. So I apologize in advance, is we have to have evidence and show proof that the disability is negatively impacting a child's education. That's how they get an IEP, or impeding a child's education. Right. That's mm-hmm. why I used to put them, like, just because they're diagnosed autistic, just because they're diagnosed ADD, ADHD, doesn't automatically get them one. Even students who are deaf or hard of hearing, I know some that have had a hard time getting an IEP as well. So that's why I tell people, I'm like, there has to be like a evidence that there's barriers.
And it kind of reminds me of my journey of getting on Social Security, because my first time we applied for it, it kept coming back with, oh, you can do menial labor. You can do menial labor. You can do menial labor. And then the second time we went through a disability lawyer, and they told us what you do is, once you get that third denial, they're going to ask you if you want to appeal with a court case and the lawyer. You do that, and then you'll get the case, and then you go in front of a judge. And I went in front of the judge and told my story. And then you have to convince the vocational woman that any job she shows, you can't do. And we proved to them that because of the fact I don't know when it was right and wrong to say something, that any job that you work with people is wrong, because you working with people is hard. So we left it. And then about a couple of months later, I was awarded my Social Security.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. There are those who can get it easily because they are more severe on the autism scale. And then there are those of us who are high functioning, like you and me, who would, they would just say, hey, you don't feel like the type of person, autistic person who can work. You can work. We're going to deny you.
Well, and I've never even thought of doing Social Security because I've always wanted to work. Even if it's part-time jobs, I want to work. And I feel like Social Security, you know, is a whole other ballgame. I don't know enough about it really to talk on it. But I feel like if you are able, you should try. And there's a lot of other resources, you know, like I know people who work and are able to kind of like do both. But I think, you know, United States and the world in general is very black and white on this issue, you know? And I would say that, you know, for people who have higher service needs, it's really a struggle because like they fit into that category perfectly. And for people who have lower service needs, they fit into this one. But the people who are in the middle, you know, maybe who need more supports here, like we can work what we need these accommodations, we can work and we need this. That's where it's a real struggle is the gray, you know, the outliers. Mm-hmm. And there's more outliers than there are in the extreme side of the spectrum when it comes to support needs.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, I've talked with people all over the world and they are better in supporting those who are autistic than we are here in the U.S.
Yeah, across the board. But I would say we're also lucky because there are some countries that don't even have like the IDEA Act. That's a law. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the workforce. Why do you think there's such a divide between the workforce and those of us who are neurodivergent?
Oh, man. Accessibility, understanding, and there's a lot of reasons. And there's a lot of different perspectives and opinions on this. That's why I joined the NeuroDrive team, right? It was because I wanted to support people. and we all have different stories on that team. The things we have found kind of that are consistent is accommodations and modifications. Employers don't really want to honor that. They don't want to work with disabled people. We're in a high competition workforce where you are replaceable. And so even though legally you can't, employers find a way. To discriminate, et cetera. So I think that people on a more macro are scared of what they don't understand and they don't know. And that applies a lot with the disabled community, you know, like across all disabilities, I would say there's a, I don't know and I don't understand, so I'd rather not deal with.
All right. Would that be the reason why there's such a high unemployment rate with those of us who are autistic? Because companies are just afraid to hire us?
Firstly, yes. I think that accommodations are, like, we did a survey. I know a few surveys that said accommodations are the number one issue across all disabilities. That includes autism. And then you have most autistic people when surveyed. I think Autism Career Pathways did a survey where it was like, 70% want to do part-time work, you know? So finding our niche, finding where we fit, I think is the other problem. And autism is such a large spectrum, particularly now that they added Asperger into it, the old Asperger diagnosis, because there are people who have issues with like social reciprocity and in a workplace that's very different accommodations and needs you need than someone who maybe has overstimulation issues, you know, who's like, I need these different accommodations. So I don't know why there's such a high number. I would say it's so many different things, right? Like you have your bottle of water and it's all these different reasons of why. Workplace discrimination is definitely another part of it too, right? Like we're not a good fit because maybe we're not making eye contact. Maybe we've said something that's inappropriate that we don't know that's inappropriate. And I say we being like an autistic individual. So really, there's a lot of different reasons why autistics aren't employed. And I mean, when I heard, I was like 1% of autistics that had a career, that blew my mind. I was not okay with that. And that was before the pandemic. So, you know, I will say, I don't know the numbers now, but the pandemic did shift into this more at-home environment, right? Where we could do Zoom meetings. And it really has changed workplace accessibility. and what it means to go to work. So I'm hoping we continue to ride that hybrid position. A lot of autistic and neurodiverse or neurodistinct, there's so many words, right? Individuals love hybrid positions, mm-hmm. myself included. So that's where I think that as this continues, we'll see maybe those numbers change, right? Because now we can, within the safety of my own home, I do most of my own accommodations now. I don't have to rely on the employer as much. So,
do you think more companies should follow the suit of like Microsoft and some of the other companies that have a autism program to help them and hire them because they understand the autism community?
Yes and no. Here's why. Yes, I love the idea of autistics hiring autistics and getting them into the workforce. It's something I'm a huge believer in. You know, the hiring system is definitely a part of the issue. But once you get them in the door, accommodations is the other one. So like, I know a lot of people I've worked with where it's like, I got hired, then I got fired real quick. So it needs to be an ongoing support, not just hiring. So I'm all about it, right? Like, I think HR reform, human resource reform is something I'm a big believer in, you know, and really changing how human resources work across the globe. Because I think companies are not doing it right. And they have the law to back them up, sadly, in this case, you know, like legally, you know, like if they're encouraged to push out disabled people, you know, by giving them enough trials, et cetera. So I think, yes, Microsoft and those companies are in the right direction, but I wish it wasn't just autism too, right? So where's the ongoing support once you are hired? And then why is it only autism? Why can't it be all neurodiverse people? Because I think every neurodiverse, neurodistinct, you know, could really benefit from that.
Now, is there a way we can have companies understand that hiring those of us who are autistic is a good thing? I mean, how do we I guess the question is, how do we educate a company that autistics are good people who are hard workers?
I think it's a lot of advocates are doing that, right? They're giving that why. NeuroDrive does a phenomenal job at the why, you know, why hire us? And I've worked with a couple or collaborated with a couple other places where that wasn't always the center. And I think that it is important, right? You want to give solutions. So like, if there are problems, how can companies handle this? If something else we found helps, and that's what NeuroDrive does. We offer solutions. Like, you know, offer mediation, offer different perspective, offer that, like, these are hard workers. Here's how you can work with them, right? Here's how you communicate. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ali is phenomenal at communication. Like, she does this whole thing about, like, how to communicate within management. Go to NeuroDrive. We have a bunch of courses for businesses on this. It's amazing. Jessica Michaels is incredible at training managers on how to work and manage neurodiverse people. So that's why that question, I would say, go to NeuroDrive and you've got all the resources there for you, because that's all we do is talk about the why here. And then companies are more willing to listen because it's like, we're not just giving problems, we have solutions. So yeah, I love NeuroDrive.
So the reason you would say the reason companies are hesitant in hiring is because they're more afraid and they don't have the right tools to work with those of us.
I would say, yeah. And that's in a world where I am giving companies the benefit of the doubt too, right? It's a two-way street. I want them to give neurodiverse people the benefit of the doubt. I do the same for them. So, and then having open conversations also has been, you know, being invited to companies to do these lectures and these talks has been very eye-opening as well. Like, you'll see the, you know, the higher ups are like, wow. And then you watch all the employees just do love and like supports and these like Zoom things. So I think that it, you know, advocates being a part of the workforce are important, and the voices are vocalizing for others. And not every story is the same, right? So I think showing that spectrum of workers and the spectrum of experiences is super important.
Now, here's the question that is, I mean, it's big and everywhere around. Should an employee put down their disabled on the application, or should they tell them afterwards in the interview if they get the job?
This is so hard, because I will share something, my own personal experience. So I'm a teacher. I work in special education, and I did a bunch of online teaching positions to go with my English credential mm-hmm. and degree. I have a master's in special education, but I was like, I really wanted to teach English again. And I found that on the place documents that I said I was autistic, I didn't even get an interview.
Wow.
But when I didn't disclose, I got the interview. And then about 50% of the time in interview, I would either get the position or not. So I would say this is where it sucks. I wish I could say, yeah, disclose. But right. And so this is where we're in a really corrupt system. And a lot of information came out actually about bots recently and online applications mm-hmm. that a bot kind of automatically docks you if you are disabled.
Like it's wow.
Yeah. It, like 50%.
I didn't realize docked. You get so, docked a point off of that your interview process if you put disabled. That's not fair.
And it's messed up. Right. Like I always tell people, I'm like, it's not OK. And this is a bot doing this. So the algorithm did it. And the bots right now that are doing online hiring are so bad. Like I remember one of them, oh my God, I think it's on the Daily Show or Last Week Tonight, where he was talking about the bot thought it was Last Week Tonight, John Oliver. And he was saying the bot straight up thought that everyone named Jared who played lacrosse in high school was the only people it would hire for the company. So it's not even just like against neurodiverse people, right? It's like, mm-hmm. but so companies right now are relying on new tech for the application process that is not only extremely biased against everybody, right? Like my name's not Jared. I didn't play lacrosse, so I couldn't work at this company. So I think that's also something else you have to remember when you're applying to a job is it's not even just the workplace trying to be biased, right? It might be something else behind the scenes. So I usually don't disclose until the interview. That's kind of been my trick. I found that helped. And I always script myself, right? I'm like, I'm autistic. And it's so funny because if you look at my resume, you know, it says like IEP advocate, like you would think they would think I was autistic.
Yeah.
But I had so many workplaces go, we didn't think you were autistic. And then I don't get the job. And I'm like, wow, that speaks to who you are, especially in education. So mm-hmm. I would say just it's not personal. I have stopped taking it a long time ago personally. I'm more so I'm like their loss. Yeah, right. Like I'm and making sure you apply to a job that is applicable for you. So like special education is really specialized. So I know I'm in high demand. And sped jobs, they love that I'm disabled. They're like, yeah. So that's where I, you know, not everyone could be a special educator, but kind of being aware of your audience too. So yeah, I know it sounds horrible to admit, but I don't usually disclose until an interview. And then it's a fun conversation to have actually. You know, you'll get the very ableistic, I didn't think you were autistic. Whoa. But it's coming from a good place, I found most of the time, because they actually think that's a compliment. So
yeah.
Like I said, I wish I could tell people, yeah, disclose, no problem. But there are too many factors, especially when this whole bot information came out, that I have to sadly discourage it now, you know? So I'm sorry. It's not like the nicest.
All right. Let's switch gears a little bit and go away from the workforce and talk a little bit about school. How can we educate these teachers of old who work who have been working for years on how to handle those of us who are autistic? Because I've heard stories of teachers not knowing how to handle those who are have ADHD because they're yes. constantly moving
or yes. they want to hit the,
or they hit the child. What yes. do you do?
Well, I think as a parent or guardian, I have a course for that. Because I do. It's a big advocacy. Really, for as an educator, it was a lot of conversations holding them accountable. I have had to hold teachers who were like, I've taught for 40 years, and I actually got to let go a few of them because they were not honoring IEPs. So remembering that not all teachers are bad, step one. Step two, I would say, is just advocating, right? Like going to the principal, your resources at the school, and be like, this is happening, like, and complain, write it down, vocalize it. I saw my parents I work with, I love my loud, obnoxious advocate parents because you guys will not be silenced. And it is, I mean it as a compliment. You have to be loud and obnoxious for people to listen to you in education. And it's not right, but it is truly what's happening. And, you know, pursue it. Do not, I've worked with a lot of parents in my IEP advocacy with lawyers and everything because of situations like you're talking about. And these schools do get brought down. Those educators do get held accountable. And it's a long, rigorous process, but you can do it. So I think just holding these teachers accountable is so important. And there's a huge paradigm shift in teaching as well. So the old school teacher you're talking about is what we call a deficits-based model. They think of all the things a child cannot do. They cannot sit still. They cannot, right, do the assignment. Mm-hmm. They cannot do. Whereas the, you know, you'll hear a lot of teachers say you're supposed to say person with autism. The person first model is think about all the things we can do. So an example of the child who's super hyper, who can't sit still, if I allowed them to fidget, they're able to do the work, mm-hmm. right? I have a lot of kids that want to go run a lap. They're frustrated and they'll go like run a lap outside. They come back in, right on task. So you find ways within accommodations and modifications, particularly in education, to work with these kids and you'll see how much they thrive, right? And I push for my students to ask for it. You know, I had one kid, he was in second grade. He'd be like, lap time. And I'm like, all right, give me 5 minutes and then you can go do a lap. He's like, okay. I had my little timer on his thing, 5 minutes, we'd go run a lap. And it was so funny because the teacher was like, I thought he was going to sit on your lap at first. And then I realized he went outside and ran. And I was like, well, you took it very literally. And she joked. She's like, I had an odd moment, didn't I? I was very literal. And go you, Corinne. So allowing that humor also, right? Like I could have gotten so offended, but instead I was like, yeah, you did. And look at you, like you learned. And she's like, exactly. So having conversations about what to do instead of focusing on what kids can't do, I would argue is because, right, that anger comes from somewhere, from both the educator and from the student or child situation.
I mean, that kind of reminds me when I was in high school, my parents used to get calls from my teacher all the time because they didn't know I was autistic back then. All they knew is I had ADHD, right. And they'd get calls that said, Reed can't sit still in class. Until one day they got calls of this. You want to hear something funny? Reed's sitting still in one of his classes and he's paying attention and he's focused. And it turned out it was my general science class. And at that point, they knew something was different with me.
Right. Because that was probably like your area of interest.
My area of interest. Yeah. It was my focus.
Yeah. A lot of my students, that's the best way to tell is like they're so into it and like they get excited. And I would be like, yes. So I miss working with them, but yeah.
And they info dump on you all this stuff they love to learn.
Oh, it's so cool. As a resource specialist, like case manager, I would write that down. I'm like, they are so into this subject. Like, and I would start using it. Like, so I had a student who's really into science. And so he did a research paper for his English class. And then we did a science fiction for their creative writing. So we started using it, right? I was like, let's use this area and just expand it. So I think that's why I said the paradigm shift right now for younger educators more so. And a lot of older educators are really buying it. Like, too, it's just taking longer because they weren't taught this, right? It's mm-hmm. So like in my teaching program, I was taught all of this already, whereas older teachers weren't. No. So that's why I said it's a real weird kind of melsh. And I would say, you know, as a parent or guardian, really know your rights and fight it. Right. Like if it doesn't feel right, there's a reason. So
you talk a lot about a mind your autistic brain. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
So Mind Your Autistic Brain is a phenomenal web series. It's a kind of like what you do. You know, she does interviews and everything. And I work for the subdivision as a contracted worker. I am the Accessibility and Accommodations Director for the NeuroDrive team. And NeuroDrive, we focus more on, we have four different subsects. We have English, we have education, I can speak today, education, medical, and workforce. Those are like our three main areas we're really focusing in on and educating nurses and doctors and teachers and, you know, businesses. So we have a lot of courses we offer we're working on courses to offer for them. And then I I'm well, part of the education sector as well. So it, I love it. I get to teach parents, what is an IEP? How can you advocate? How do you teach your child how to advocate? How do you transition from college, sorry, high school to college? So I, it's a really all women. LG loves neurodistinct. It's a neurodistinct female led business. So every woman has a disability. And we are all women. So it's absolutely fabulous. And I'm excited for the direction we're going.
Yeah, I wish I had something like that, because I took the huge risk of going overseas to college for my master's. It was a huge jump for me.
Yeah. Where'd you go?
I went to the University of Kent in Canterbury, England.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was. And then I traveled 6 weeks through Europe on my own. I mean, for someone who's autistic, it was a huge jump.
Yeah. Oh my God, I bet. And I think talking about that, like, our younger generations have to remember we are on the others made it this way. You know, like Julie, yeah, I don't even know how to say her last name, but Human, you know, she passed away this week, and she was like a huge like creator of disability rights. Mm-hmm. And so I found like within my own advocacy, like you said, right, like we make large leaps and faiths and jumps on the backs of our predecessors. And we wouldn't be able, right, to even have like accommodations had it not been for people like that. So I have been so honored to work with and meet incredible advocates like Temple Grandin. Changed my life big time. Mm. She was another huge, she said, the world needs to know your story. And I was not ready at the time to share it. So just really honoring those before us and keep going, right? Like, we're not gonna stop. They started this, let's keep it going. So yeah. Yeah.
I actually got to interview her.
You did.
She was such a fascinating woman.
Yeah.
Dr. Grandin, I mean, she was so much, so focused on her own work, her books, her movies, but she's right. She's like, the younger generation doesn't understand. She told me a story about how she had a girl in her class who, they have this barn down the road that they work at, and they're they all have cell phones. They don't know how to use them. The barn was like, it said, her phone says it was 10 minutes away, but she went to walk in and it took her 2 hours and she didn't realize it meant 10 minutes by car.
Yep. I've done that. Well, and that's kind of like, you know, when it comes to disability advocacy, it's changed, right? We have Zoom and online platforms now and technology, and it is really good. And yet, yeah, I work with young kids. They don't seem to understand that like we got here somehow and a lot of different things in society, and disability advocacy is definitely one of them. So.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and Mind Your Autistic Brain?
Well, I'll be giving you a link for Mind Your Autistic Brain, the NeuroDrive subdivision. They're amazing. Carol Jane Whittington, the whole team of girls, or should say women, sorry, are just amazing human beings. You can also follow me on Instagram. Let's Talk About Autism. Also on LinkedIn, I'm Corinne, as you found me, right? Like Corinne and Gilmore on there as well. So yeah, I also have, if you look on my linked tree on LinkedIn and on Instagram, you can book a little appointment with me to chit chat. So, you know, I usually do 30 minutes free, and then sorry guys, I do charge for everything else. So I think it's just really important. You know, I try my best to help you out. If I don't know, I'll find a way, right? Or I'll give you to someone who does know. So, ever learning.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. That was Karen Gillimore, autism advocate, and I'll see you in the next one. See you there, everyone. Bye, Karen.
While the sky burned, getting getting high off of the fumes, feeling like the bombs outside of flowers. Me and you stay watching through the glass as the moon came. Bodies holding hands, feeling truly like our lives are movies. I swear a solid dream, no need to be afraid. Someday we'll fall asleep and won't recall a thing. Some believe there's no escape, like paint's poster. But I just don't agree, I love the way we see the world. I love the way we see the world. I love the way we see the world.